I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up, do dogs love us? Canine behaviorist Clive Wynn says, yes, they do. His book, Dog is Love, traces the evolution of dogs and argues that love is at the root of the canine-human relationship. But first, dogs and coronavirus. Now, we know that dogs with their highly developed sense of smell have been able to detect certain diseases like cancer and malaria. With the global pandemic crisis, can they sniff out coronavirus? Eight Labrador retrievers are involved with a University of Pennsylvania study to answer that question. And joining us to explain what they are looking to understand is Cynthia Odd, and she's a professor of working dog sciences and sports medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Vets Working Dog Center. And Cynthia, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here, Marty.
And to our listeners, as always, you can join the conversation, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. So, Cynthia, how is this research being conducted?
So we are looking at answering a really simple proof of concept question: is there an odor associated with COVID-19 infection? And we're using the dogs in a similar way to how we use them in our ovarian cancer detection. So we're collecting samples from patients. We're training the dogs to sniff those samples. And when they sniff the samples from a patient that's positive, they get a reward. When they sniff a sample from a patient that's negative, they don't get anything, and they start to identify what is unique about those samples from COVID-19 positive samples. So that's where we're starting.
And what kind of samples are we talking about?
So right now we're looking at urine samples and saliva samples, and we may be looking at breath samples.
At breast samples on top of that. That's fascinating. We know about, you know, dogs' extraordinary noses, and it's interesting to see sort of how you, I guess, reward behavior, their behavior when they're sensing someone who is COVID positive.
Right. So it's basically, it's the same as we would do for an explosive detection dog or a drug detection dog, although this we find is a lot harder for the dogs because not only do they have to identify where the odor is, they have to identify where it's not. So they have to ignore the samples that don't have the odor and really focus on tell us which samples do have the odor.
Now, we're talking about Labrador retrievers. Is there something special about their noses?
Labradors are wonderful, and they have been bred for generations for hunting, and so they really are kind of geared for that. But, you know, they're not unique in that. So many breeds of dogs are able to do this type of detection work. The reason we are going with Labrador retrievers is actually twofold. One, we were able to identify a number of Labrador retrievers that could participate in the study. And if we do translate this to a point where we're actually screening live humans, we find that the Labrador retrievers are a little bit more acceptable to the public than, say, our German Shepherds or some of our other more intimidating breeds of dogs.
Oh, well, that's interesting that people have a kind of a benign feel for Labrador retrievers.
I think, you know, all you have to do is look at a picture of a Labrador puppy and everyone just smiles. And so, you know, it's
fair enough.
There's something universal about the Labrador.
Now, we're all living under the pandemic. Are dogs living under the pandemic as well?
So dogs are definitely in the mix, but what we know is that they are really not getting this disease unless they're in very unique situations. So there have been probably four dogs that have been confirmed with the disease, and they've been, you know, with families that have been very heavily affected. And some of these dogs appear to be older dogs. They may have other medical problems that, you know, set them up. We just don't know enough, since there have been so few dogs that have actually had the disease. That said, we're going to be paying really close attention to these dogs and making sure that they're safe. So all of the samples that we're working with will have the virus inactivated, so there won't be any live virus that we're working with. If we get to the point where we're screening live humans, we are going to take every precaution, maximizing the distance that the dogs are alerting from. The people being screened will have masks on, so that's going to decrease you know, their contagion. We're going to be monitoring the dogs. We're going to be practicing the best decontamination methods and really evaluating to make sure that these dogs aren't having any adverse effects.
Is this stressful for dogs to be engaged in this kind of research?
The dogs generally really like it. They love using their brains, and mostly they love getting the treats that are associated with it.
For
some dogs, it's too much brain work, you know. So for some dogs, they're just not cut out for this type of intense, focused work. And so if that's the case, then those dogs won't be participating. So, you know, it really is about the dogs that enjoy doing this so that they can do it well.
Now, how long do you think, it sounds like you're in the very beginnings of this experiment, how long do you think it will take to get to some kind of results whether dogs can sniff out coronavirus or not?
So we anticipate that we'll get a yes-no answer about whether there's an odor, and we expect that to be within about 4 weeks of the time that we get the samples. And we're hoping to have the samples maybe as early as next week. It just all depends on what our collaborators are able to do with us.
And you said this several times, but I just want to make sure we all understand it. So the question is there an odor associated with COVID-19?
So that's what we're testing. Right. We actually don't know if there's an odor associated. We anticipate there is. Every evidence that all, you know, other diseases have a unique odor, whether it's cancer or malaria or bacterial infections. And certainly we know that influenza has a unique odor, even associated with the virus as well as the infection. So we suspect that there will be a unique odor. And, you know, if anybody can figure it out, the dogs can.
So let's say there is an odor and the dogs can figure it out. What happens next?
So we've got a couple of stages. So the first stage is that yes, no. The second stage is, can the dogs actually find that odor if a person's carrying the container? So transitioning from a very clean, sterile almost environment of the laboratory to, can we find that odor in a closer to real world environment is the next step. If they can figure out in the background of smelly people that this odor is still identifiable, then one of our ultimate goals would be to evaluate whether we could use these dogs to help screen people in public settings, whether that's in a, you know, airport or train station or in a business or a hospital. So they would identify the patients that have that odor, and then those patients would be selected to have the specific testing to confirm it.
Do you think that would even apply to people who are asymptomatic carriers?
So absolutely, our goal is to be able to use these dogs to help identify asymptomatic carriers. And we know that in malaria detection, the dogs have been able to identify asymptomatic carriers in that situation. In our cancer detection, our dogs are still alerting to the stage one cancer patients, which are oftentimes, you know, very early on in the disease. So we're hopeful, but it's going to take a lot of work, science, making sure we're doing it in the best and safest way, and really using the knowledge of our collaborators to make this the best and safest approach.
I was reading about something called the Canine Civilian Corps. Does that make sense to you, and perhaps having dogs stationed at airports sniffing out coronavirus?
So I think that that is a really interesting and exciting area, and we've had lots of people contact us wanting to train their dogs to do this. And I think it may be one of the only ways that we can have enough dogs to start screening, but there's a lot of challenges with it. It really is going to be about the safety of the dogs, of the people, and also training so that our accuracy is really high, because we don't want dogs that mean well but aren't up to the task out there giving us wrong information.
Well, we know, and you know better than most about the just extraordinary features of a dog's nose. Do you think it would be possible even to take those features and create some kind of electronic nose so that we can, in a sense, have an electronic nose do what a dog's nose can do?
So absolutely, that's part of our strategy, particularly as we're working with ovarian cancer, and our collaborator, Dr. Charlie Johnson, who's at the University of Pennsylvania, has been developing an electronic nose, and wow, it's very promising. And so I think once we have that yes, no, is there an odor, that's really going to give him the green light to kind of push his electronic nose to see if he can also use that for COVID-19. And also there's some chemistry approaches. Dr. Audrey John at Children's Hospital is working with us, and she's screening these samples to look at the chemical signature of the odor. And so there may be additional screening methods that are derived from what we're doing with the dogs.
It's also fascinating. Help us understand just the complexity of dogs' nose and their ability to smell. It's just, it's really a phenomenal thing, and I just want to make sure our listeners understand it.
Yeah, their noses are so incredible, and they're anatomically, so they're structured in a way that really optimizes their capture of odor. So the way they breathe, the way they breathe in and out, the little slits on the sides of their noses, the way there's like almost a honeycomb arrangement in their noses. The part of their breath is directed right towards the olfactory recess, which is where all of the smelling takes place. They have receptors which capture the odors and communicate that to their brains. Those receptors, they have much higher density. They have more receptors. They have more genes for these kinds of receptors than we do. The part of their nose, their brain that actually processes this information is larger than in the human. And then to me, the really important thing is that dogs are so connected to people that they are able and willing to communicate this information readily to us, that yes, this is what I'm smelling. And cats are really quite capable. They're not always as willing.
Having lived with both, I would agree with you on that. And we're going to be talking more about what you just said with our guest who's waiting in the wings. But I hear from you, Cynthia, just this great passion and love for dogs.
Absolutely love them.
I mean, this is what you do every day, right?
You know, they make our lives whole.
So you said by next week, maybe beginning to understand whether there's a sort of yes-no response to whether there is an odor, and then things go from there?
Well, by next week, we're hoping to actually start introducing them to the samples. Okay. And so it'll take us a couple of weeks to have confidence that what we're seeing is real or that there is no odor. But if I was a betting person, I would bet on the fact that there will probably be an odor.
Oh, so exciting. Cynthia, as always, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's Cynthia Ott. She's a professor of working dog sciences and sports medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Working Dog Center at Penn School of Veterinary Medicine, and talking about some fascinating research about whether dogs will be able to sniff out COVID-19. And we do have Clive Wynn waiting in the wings. He's got a book, came out just a couple months ago, called Dog is Love. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. Marty Moss.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. So what to do when living under stay-at-home orders? Get a dog. Shelters and rescue organizations report that rates of dog adoptions have risen dramatically in the last few months. There's more time to bond and spend time with your four-legged friend. And as someone who has lived with dogs my entire life, the rewards of canine companionship are incalculable. We asked Clive Wynn to join us. He's the founding director of the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University, author of Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. Now, I assume when my dog Cole looks at me with adoring eyes or runs to greet me when I get home that he loves me, but what does that mean? Clive Wynn says that dogly affection is built into their brains, their behavior, their DNA. And he joins us on Radio Times to talk about his research and what it reveals about the dog-human relationship. And Clive Wynn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have him?
Oh, hello.
Oh, hi, Clive. That was a long pause there. Hi, Clive Wynn. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Mazi, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
You're very welcome. Let me just make sure our listeners know how to join our conversation. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us at 1-888-477-9499. Are you surprised that so many people are adopting dogs during the pandemic?
No, Marty, I think it makes good sense. I certainly understand why people who are stuck at home with a very limited range of human companions are interested in taking on a dog. I mean, I don't understand why anybody who has the option, whose life has a dog-shaped space in it, why not take on a dog into your life? I mean, they are the most wonderful companions, right? I mean, they're so loving, and compared to our human family members, relatively little demanding.
Well, it's funny. I posted something on our Facebook page yesterday with a picture of my dog, Cole, and just asking people to post pictures of their dogs. And we have, I lost count, so many people that just posted a picture. This is my dog. This is me and my dog. I mean, it is this extraordinary relationship that human beings have with their animal companions, their dogs.
That's right. That's right. It's a bond that goes back 15, 20,000 years or more. I mean, it's very deeply ingrained in the natures of both sides of the partnership, I think.
Help us. I know as a scientist, you don't really use the word love, but it is in the title of your book. What do you mean, or what does a dog experience if they apparently, allegedly love us?
Well, right, Marty. I mean, this is a struggle, a story that I tell in my book, Dog is Love, about how, you know, I was trained as a behaviorist. That's a relatively hard-nosed kind of animal behavior scientist. And we always try and only use terms when we're describing animal behavior that can be viewed as objective, that a fellow scientist, even a skeptic, could understand what we were getting at. And I was therefore nervous, reticent, slow to bring out the L word. You know, it's a four-letter word, and in my scientific apprenticeship, it was the very last kind of thing we could possibly allow ourselves to say. And yet, as I found myself collecting evidence, behavioral evidence, you know, the kind of thing that anybody who lives with a dog has seen, right? When you go away and you come back, your dog is crazy happy to see you again.
Yep.
I mean, that's an everyday experience, but it's a powerful piece of evidence. And then I also have been involved myself in research into the genetic bases of dog behavior and trying to understand what makes the difference between a dog and a wolf. And other scientists in other parts of the world who've looked at the hormones in dogs' bodies and in their brains and so on and so forth. And we're coming up with these long terms, you know, exaggerated gregariousness. You know, that's one scientific sounding phrase that we were using. And hypersociability, that's another one. And at a certain point, I realized we're just making up polysyllabic words and phrases to avoid using the L word, because when it comes down to it, what a scientist means by hypersociability and exaggerated gregariousness, these are just what everybody else calls love, right? I mean, this isn't some kind of nuclear physics type thing where an ordinary person has no word for, you know, the terms that quantum physicists use or whatever. This is stuff that exists in everyday language, and everyday language has a word for it. So rather than being intentionally and willfully obscure, hey, let's just call a spade a spade. Your dog loves you. It's really as simple as that.
Well, fair enough. And I want to pick up on all the things that you just said there. But one of the we know about dog intelligence, and there's been a lot of research on that. But you say really dog affection, their affection, even for human beings, is one of their keys, or perhaps is the key to their success.
So, Marty, scientists have been interested in dogs for at least a century. And for the past several decades, a number of scientists around the world have been interested in this question, what makes dogs special? Because it's clear that dogs are remarkable animals. They are phenomenally successful. There are dogs on every continent of the planet, and there are about 1 billion dogs, so they're the most widespread, the most numerous animal. And so scientists have been asking themselves, what is the clue? What makes dogs so remarkable? And some scientists have drawn attention to dogs' intelligence. Now, just because my own dog isn't smart doesn't mean that I don't recognize that there are smart dogs out there.
Zenos,
I know,
right?
That.
Yeah.
I know. And I know you had Dr. Otto on a little earlier. And, you know, there are dogs that have been trained to do amazing, amazing things, wonderful things. But I've worked over my career with many different species. And the truth is that with enough patience, you can train other species to do many of the things that we commonly train dogs to do. Rats can sniff out explosives. And, you know, it's not that I used to train pigeons to do things. That's for another day. I don't believe, although I know there are smart dogs, I don't believe that it's intelligence that makes dogs stand out. I think that the reason dogs stand out, the reason dogs are so successful in the modern world, isn't their smarts, but I like to say it's their hearts. It's that they have a truly remarkable capacity, desire, drive to form strong emotional bonds with, well, pretty much anything, so long as they meet one of them during the first 3 months of life. So we see our dogs forming loving relationships with human beings because we are human beings. So that's our perspective. But I have met dogs who love goats. These are livestock guarding dogs on a ranch in Arizona. The puppies are put with goats when they're young, and they grow up looking to form strong emotional bonds with goats. Hey, in Australia, they've done the same trick with penguins. And they have dogs that take care of penguins on an island where the penguins are under threat from foxes that sometimes get out there at low tide. So that, I think, Marty, I'm convinced, is the secret superpower of dogs, is an amazing drive, capacity, desire to form strong emotional bonds. That's why we love them, because they really do love us.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. Let me pick up on, you've done a lot of interesting research, and one was looking at trying to sort of understand this emotion that we see in dogs and to try to understand it from their perspective. You've done some research where a human being fakes crying, and the dog has a certain kind of reaction. Tell us about that research, and what does it tell us about dogs?
Well, sure. I wasn't the one who thought up this experiment. This experiment originated with researchers in London, but actually, it's an experience anybody can have who wants to try it for themselves. You just sit down on the sofa and pretend to cry, and your dog, in all likelihood, will be very upset. Now, if you're actually actively pretending to cry, you may have your hands over your eyes. It may be difficult to see what's going on. So, I suggest setting up your cell phone in a convenient corner so that you can video record your dog's reactions. And you'll see that your dog's behavior is full of distress and concern. And it's very simple. And for most dogs, you don't even have to be that good an actor. Right. They are very quickly upset. Now, the experiment that my students and I have done took this a little bit further. And we asked ourselves, well, okay, so it's easy to obtain evidence that dogs are upset if they think that their human is in distress. But what would a dog be willing to do? Now, there's the old TV show of Lassie. You know, what's that, Lassie? Timmy's fallen down the well. So yeah, obviously that's fiction, right? We know that dogs are unable to bark articulately, that they can actually convey to a person what the nature of a problem is. But is there any evidence, we wondered, that dogs really would try and help a person who is in distress if they could understand what to do? And so, Marty, we had people climb into a box that was just big enough to hold a person. And we closed the door to the box, but we designed it so the door would open very, very easily. Then we asked the person to cry out in distress, and we let their dog into the room to see what their dog would do. Would the dog open the box to let their owner free from this apparent distress? And the answer is not all dogs will, because that's simply because a lot of dogs cannot understand how to open the box. We're not training them to do anything. We're just looking to see what their spontaneous reaction is. And a lot of dogs are not able to figure out how to open the box, even if we let them watch us put food inside the box. But those dogs that can understand how the box opens, they rescue their owners. And we have the cutest videos. We have two video cameras to capture all the angles, and we see the dog's behavior. And, you know, most people can read dog behavior really well. And you see how the dog is so upset and distressed and is running around, getting close to panic. And then they figure out how to open the box and they get back in contact with their owner. And they're so happy. Mm. It's so sweet to see.
Absolutely. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Clive Wynn, and he's the founding director of the Canine Science Collaboratory. That's at Arizona State University. He wrote a book called Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. There's a syndrome that some humans have called William-Boren syndrome. It's a genetic issue where they are just exuberantly affectionate to everybody. And it seems as if, I'm not sure if all dogs, but enough dogs have enough of this that seems to explain their sociability, their gregariousness.
Well, right, Marty. So if we think we've discovered something that's part of the unique story of the dog, ultimately, everything in biology is written in the genes. If there's something special about dogs that makes them different from other animals, then that must be detectable in their DNA. Yeah. And so my collaborators and I got in touch with a geneticist, Bridget von Holt, who had already started looking at the DNA of dogs and comparing it to the DNA of wolves. All of our dogs are descended from wolves. So that's where you go looking to see what might be unique about dogs. And along the way, Bridget von Holt, the geneticist, had already identified that there were changes in a part of the dog genome, which if a human has changes to that part of their genetic material, means that they have this syndrome you mentioned, Williams-Buren syndrome. Williams-Buren syndrome actually involves a lot of different genes and has a wide range of impact. So people with Williams-Buren syndrome have a rather strange facial structure, they have heart deficits, they have a whole bunch of things going on. But one of the most remarkable is that they are exceptionally friendly. They seem to pretty much love everybody. They're phenomenally loving people. And this seems to be the only syndrome that has that as part of its package. And so we carried out some behavioral tests on dogs, measuring their friendliness, which was very simple stuff. And we carried out the same tests on some hand-reared wolves out of Wolf Park in Indiana. And these wolves have been with people all their lives. They appear to be pretty friendly. But nonetheless, when we compared them on our tests with dogs, the dogs are way, way more affectionate towards people than the wolves are. And then we sent Bridget von Holt DNA samples from the dogs that we tested and from the wolves that we tested. And she went looking, and sure enough, she identified three genes that changed from wolf to dog and that are responsible for this big change in the affectionateness, the friendliness, the loving nature from wolves to dogs. Wolves can be quite friendly. Wolves have really quite strong relationships with people that they have grown up with if they're hand-reared wolves, but they don't have anything like the same outgoing friendliness that's typical of many dogs. Now, we don't know for a fact that every dog has this. We're still working on it. We started doing the initial discovery was done on a fairly small group of dogs, but we are now going out, and it will be very interesting to see, do all the different breeds of dog have this to the same degree? Do all different individual dogs have it to the same level? We don't know the answers to those questions yet, but that's where we're going next.
No, that's fascinating stuff. Here's a question from Philip. It says, if we're actually choosing dogs that look like they're smiling, do we have a false sense of a dog's sense of attachment? And, I mean, dogs do look like they're smiling when they look like they're smiling. Are they smiling? Is that a smile?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Marty. And I remain uncertain about that. Now, your caller suggested that people select dogs because they look like they're smiling. People select dogs for all sorts of different reasons. I've never heard of a study that's actually attempted to pin down what are the dominant reasons that people choose dogs. So we don't know that people are choosing dogs because they're smiling. And it's not established as a scientific fact whether dogs actually smile or not. What I find very, very interesting, Marty, is that we typically read the behavioral expressions of our dogs very easily, even though in many, many ways they're completely unlike human behavioral expressions. So the most obvious thing is the dog's tail, right? Most people who live with dogs can read their dog's feelings in how their dog moves his or her tail. And yet, we don't have tails. We don't have tails. And it's not like we move any other part of our bodies in ways that parallel how dogs use their tails to express themselves. And yet, we understand it very, very well. My dog has extremely expressive ears. I understand a lot about how she's feeling by watching her ears. And yet, I and my other human friends are completely unable to use our ears for emotional expression. So I find it very, very interesting that we read each other, we and dogs read each other's moods so well, when actually in many, many ways we're expressing our inner feelings in completely different ways.
Here's a tweet from a listener. What will be the effects on all these dogs that have been adopted during the pandemic once their owners go back to work? And these are such companionable animals, and they seem to need some kind of contact with humans or people in their lives. It is, I think, a serious question. When people go back to work, what happens to all these dogs?
Oh, Marty, that's a tremendously serious question. And you started your interview with me we started talking about people adopting dogs during the pandemic. And I expressed some enthusiasm for that. But we need to be a little careful. We need to think about, you know, not just what are our lives going to be like for the next couple of months, but the dog is going to live hopefully a decade or more. Are our lives such that structured so that we can find space for dogs in the long term? It would be a mistake to adopt a dog today because today's life provides plenty of opportunity to give the dog companionship if the dog is going to have to be left alone for extended periods of time once we go back to work. Now, I think that leaving dogs home alone is one of the cruelest things that people who don't mean to be cruel often do. And it
concerns me greatly.
You know what, Clive?
Yeah, hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break and we'll be right back to our conversation. We are talking about dogs in this hour of Radio Times with Clive Wynn, and we'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with canine behaviorist Clive Wynn. His most recent book is Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. And he says, based on research and observation, it's pretty clear that dogs do feel affection. It's in their genes. It's in their hormones. It's in their behavior, their tails, their faces. And you can join us again, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Clive, right before the break, you were saying just it's so important if people are, you know, adopting dogs during the pandemic because they're home, if and when they eventually go back to work, we need to make sure that dogs have a quality of life.
Absolutely, absolutely. So in Sweden, there are laws that prohibit people from leaving their dog home alone for more than 4 hours at a stretch. And although I wouldn't dream of suggesting that anywhere in the United States takes on Swedish law, nonetheless, I think it's a good rule of thumb to keep in mind. Now, your dog doesn't have to be with you. Remember, dogs make friends with other people and other animals very easily. If you have more than one dog, your dog can be quite happy in the company of a canine roommate. If you are forced to work all day, as of course so many people are, then your dog may be happy to have a neighbor or a friend come around and just be taken out for a coffee, maybe. And there are services that can help, you know, a doggy daycare, a dog walker. You have to watch out because there's very little regulation of any of those professions, so a bit of due diligence is always necessary, but there are good ones out there, and our dogs derive a great deal of fun and satisfaction from those kinds of things. The other possibility, Marty, is maybe rather than adopting a dog right now during the pandemic, consider fostering one. When you foster a dog, just like somebody who fosters a child, you're just taking a dog out of the kennels of the shelter for a temporary period of time, and you don't take ownership of that dog, and you can return the dog at the end of the pandemic or whenever. And we know my group has done quite a bit of research, helped by Maddie's Fund, who are a charity heavily committed to these issues. We know that it definitely cheers dogs up tremendously to be taken out into a home, even if that's only a temporary residence. It's still really good for them on many levels. And it increases their chances of finding a permanent home because they'll meet more people.
Sure.
And so it's a good thing all around, the fostering idea.
Let me ask you about dogs and hormones. And I have to say, when I'm patting my dog or just, you know, looking in deeply and lovingly into his eyes, I don't know if it's oxytocin, but I feel something, and I wonder whether the dog does as well.
Oh, yeah. So there's fascinating research actually coming out of Japan showing that when a person and their dog look into each other's eyes, if they're in a strong relationship, then levels of what people call the love hormone, oxytocin, levels of oxytocin go up on both sides of the partnership. And you can actually get oxytocin into a dog's or a person's body by spraying it up their nose. And if you do that, then you find that the dog and the person will look at each other more if they've had oxytocin sprayed up their noses. So this is one of many levels at which we see how love is programmed into the body of our dogs, just, of course, as it's programmed into our bodies.
Here's an email from Shelley who says, I've heard that dogs would not survive in the world without humans. Has domestication worked against dogs? But there, I mean, I'm not sure how many dogs there are in the world, and not all of them are living with humans.
Well, that's a really interesting point, Marty. So there are estimated to be 1 billion, that's with a B, dogs on the surface of this planet at this time. Of that 1 billion dogs, a few hundreds of millions of them are pets. So there might be 80 million pet dogs in the United States and maybe a roughly similar number in Europe and then a few tens of millions in other parts of the world. So the most of the world's dogs are not pets. If you've ever traveled in a third world country, even the Caribbean, for example, most Caribbean islands have stray dogs wandering around the streets. But those, Marty, are not truly wild animals. They do not, by and large, they cannot survive as wild animals do by hunting their own dinner. What most stray dogs are doing is eating food that was provided by human beings, but unintentionally provided. So I remember I spent a wonderful couple of days in the Bahamas around Nassau, and there are lots and lots of dogs there, and they're mainly eating trash that's landed on the streets. They're hanging around, asking people for snacks. They're not pets, but they are dependent on food that people have provided.
Richard has an interesting question. He says, occasionally dogs seem to cock their heads seemingly in puzzlement, and then he asks, are they puzzled?
Oh, well, that's a fantastic question. I really so wish I knew the answer to that. I also want to know, why do I find that so endearing? I just totally love it when a dog turns his head on one side. It looks like puzzlement, and oftentimes the situations where it occurs seem like puzzlement. There are so many fascinating questions about dogs that we still just don't know the answer to, even though so many people ask themselves these questions. Fascinating.
I have a question about howling, and I and my husband and I howl with our dog, and I'm not always sure, is he happy? Is he not happy? Is this a howl of pain or distress? It's hard to read what is coming out of his mouth.
Well, it's interesting. People usually ask me about barking, Marty, not so often about howling, because howling, of course, is less common in dogs, more common in wolves, less common in dogs. So why some dogs howl, I don't know. We do have an understanding to some degree of why many wolves howl. And the reason why wolves howl, howling is a long-distance call. It carries over very wide distances. And it's just a way of staying in touch with your pack members when, for whatever reason, you've become separated. And what's so fascinating about howling is wolves always howl out of tune with each other. And this is interesting. If you think about it, if you've ever listened to a chorus or any other situation where people are singing, when people sing perfectly in tune, you don't know how many people are there. You cannot identify individuals when a chorus sings in tune, everybody singing the exact same note. If you want to have a sense is everybody there, then you need to sing out of tune, because then your ear picks up the dissonance of the different sounds, and you can say, yeah, there must be two, three, four individuals singing those notes because I hear the dissonance that they're out of tune. So wolves howl very readily. Whenever I go out to Wolf Park in Indiana, it's always fun to howl at the wolves and have them howl back. They need that, and it's their way of keeping in contact when they're out of sight of each other. Why some dogs still do that, I don't know, because they're not commonly in a situation where other individuals are out of sight. I mean, we stay fairly close with our dogs. Dogs, of course, bark a great deal more. Wolves can also bark, but they bark very seldom. And primarily barking is what a biologist would call a mobbing call. So it's a noise that an animal makes when it feels threatened by a threat that it's incapable of escaping from or dealing with on its own. So it's calling all the troops together. Your dog is literally saying, hey, guys, I'm worried about this. I need you to come over and take a look. And if you're lucky, as I feel I am with my dog, then your dog only does that when there really is a situation that it's worth coming and taking a look. So I'm very lucky. My dog, if you stay on the sidewalk, she watches you, but she doesn't bark. You're fine. That's public territory. But if you turn off the sidewalk towards our front door, then she barks up a storm. And she's quite right. This is something that the humans need to know about. It's unlikely to be a threat, but it is something that we want to know. We want to know that somebody's about to ring the doorbell or drop a parcel or whatever might be happening.
Cassie has a question. She's saying, I live in a neighborhood where a lot of people view dogs as objects, mostly home security instead of companions. It really breaks my heart to see these neglected creatures. Can your guest suggest strategies for helping teach people empathy for dogs and other animals? I mean, that's a giant question.
Oh, well, that is a massive question. I don't know how people can do that. I don't know how people can do that. It seems that it must be a stony heart that is not moved by a dog's pleas and invitations to be in a strong relationship. Here's what I hope when I see those cases. I think those are more often men than women. And I hope that actually these are people who do care about their dogs. I'm thinking of my own late father now, who never, ever wanted to be caught expressing affection towards the dog. He thought it was unmanly. You know, that was how he was brought up. But you could tell that he did care about the dog. And if he was alone with the dog and he didn't think anybody was watching him, he would allow expressions of affection to come out. And when push came to shove, you know, if the dog really was in distress, he would help. So my hope is that those cases, I know this cannot be all of them, but my hope is that those cases of people who don't seem to care about their dog, I hope that at least some of them are just people who don't want us to know how much they care about their dog.
Yeah, I hope that is true. We probably don't have time to give a thorough answer to this question, but going back thousands of years, what was the thing that I guess was the demarcation between a wolf and a dog? And you've been talking a lot about wolves and what they have in common, but wolves are not dogs. So what happened to make a wolf a dog?
Well, Marty, that is a massive question. And I think we don't know exactly, but we are beginning to look into the mists of the past. And one thing is, it didn't happen one day. It's not like a wolf woke up one day and said, oh my goodness, I think I'm a dog now. That's really impossible. I think it happened over thousands of years, and it happened in multiple steps. And I think the very first step was that how do you know that there have been humans here? How do you know there were humans in this place? Because there's trash. One of the characteristics of our species is, unfortunately, if we stay in one spot for more than a few days, trash starts to pile up. Now, trash is by definition material that we have no further use for. But when you travel, again, especially if you travel in the third world where the resources don't exist to keep trash neat and tidy, if you go in parts of the world that are not quite as wealthy as where we're fortunate enough to live, you find that trash attracts animals. It attracts rats, it attracts mice, it attracts birds. And in many parts of the world, trash attracts wolves. This is seen in Alaska. It's seen in Scandinavia. I've seen it in Israel, actually, in the Negev Desert, of all places. Mm. And once you start, if you're a wolf or an animal in general, and you start taking an interest in human trash dumps, they're fantastic, right? The humans don't like what's left, but there's plenty there for other species to feast on. And I think a certain tribe of wolves long ago, we don't know when and we don't know where, but a certain tribe of wolves started to become specialists on scavenging human trash. So I think the very first step was not romantic and it was not noble, but it was effective because those wolves started to find that this was easier food to get than going hunting after live prey. And so they started to evolve. Their jaws became less powerful. They became perhaps a bit smaller. And it began to be useful if you could. I don't think at that stage any people had strong emotional connections to these wolfy doggy things, nor vice versa. But if you were a wolfy doggy thing who was more tolerant of people and who made themselves less threatening towards people, well, you were beginning on a journey which leads to the dogs that we love and that live with us now.
I love wolfy doggy thing as kind of a scientific term. Here's an email from William. He says, my German Shepherd loves to sing with my bagpipes, which probably does sound like howling.
Here's Dave. That's beautiful.
I'm sorry about that. Here's Dave. We have two dogs from the same litter. One is very standoffish, but the other is really loving. How do we raise these two dogs to be both friendly when they're born with different personalities? And we've been talking about dogs as if there was this one personality. But if you live with dogs, you know that they have probably as many varieties of personality as humans.
Well, and that's part of the beauty, right? I mean, even within purebred dogs, which are very highly inbred. Hey, I mean, in my book, Dog is Love Money, I tell the story, I found a guy here in Phoenix who had had his dog cloned, and I went and I visited with him, and so he still had the original mother dog, and he had two offspring dogs, and the two offspring were 2 years old, and the mother dog was 14 or 15 years old, and so I'm looking at three clones, three individual animals who have absolutely identical genetic material, and the two two-year-olds, They were carried by the same surrogate mother. They were born at more or less the same moment into the same place. They have always lived together in the same household, and yet their personalities were complete chalk and cheese. So what this tells us is genetics is important. Of course genetics is important, but genetics doesn't put any animal, not a dog, not a person, not any animal, into a straitjacket. How that plays out now, okay, they both look the same, they're the same color, the same size, the same weight, but when you look at behavior, when you look at personality, that is always such a rich interaction with the world around you that even clones can come out with really quite different personalities.
And we're almost out of time. That's true with children. I mean, you can have children within one family who have very different personalities. Just very briefly, if you don't mind, we're about 30 seconds. So, dogs are pack animals. Are we part of their pack then?
I try not to use the word pack, but the short answer, if we're looking for a short answer, is yes, absolutely. Dogs are family animals. They're group animals. They look to be in a group of individuals who have strong emotional connections with each other. That's us, and that's dogs, and that's why we love each other so much, because we expect the same kind of family structures.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Clive Wynn, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times. I feel like hopefully our audience feels the same way. I needed this conversation.
Thank you. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And he's founding director of the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University. And we've been talking about his most recent book. It's titled Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. And again, I did post a picture of my dog on our Facebook page. And go ahead and post yours as well. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.